Okay. Now we're going to take many of the aspects that we've been talking about the last three lectures, transcription, translation, and RNA structure and function. And the next few lectures, we're going to talk about how genes are regulated, how they're expressed, but we're going to break them down. Today we'll talk about how prokaryotes do it. Next week we'll talk about how eukaryotes do it. And again, hopefully you'll see that there's this dramatic difference in the way that they approach things, where prokaryotes will try to do as many things as they can with DNA sequences. Eukaryotes are going to want complex structures made out of multiple proteins to regulate things. But at their heart, there are many aspects that are similar between the way that prokaryotes and eukaryotes regulate their genes. Some terminology that we need to get through. A structural gene. Structural gene is one that encodes mRNA that will be translated into a protein. A regulatory gene is it encodes a product that somehow affects the transcription or translation of other sequences. So this is one of the definitions that's changed in the last 10 years. We used to think in terms of regulatory genes encoding proteins that regulated other genes. Okay. But now we've added in there, you don't have to encode a protein to be a regulatory gene. All of those genes that encode those inhibitory RNA molecules are regulatory genes. They affect the regulation of other genes, even though you never have to have a protein produced. Off of that RNA. The RNA itself is regulatory in nature. Okay. Then a regulatory element is some component of the DNA itself that is involved in regulation. When we talk about regulation, we mean, is it the gene expressed? Is it not expressed? If it is it expressed at a high level, at a low level, the timing of it? So gene expression is all about timing and magnitude. Okay. So structural genes are the ones being regulated. Regulatory genes encode factors that help regulate structural genes. Regulatory elements are components of the DNA. Okay, some other terms. Constitutive expression. This is a gene that is expressed all the time, basically at levels that are constant when adjusted for overall cellular activity. So if the cell is rapidly expanding, these genes would be expressed at a higher level. If the cell is basically in a low activity state, the gene is still expressed, but it can be expressed at a lower level. Some genes that are examples of that, so for example, tubulin is considered a constitutive gene. The components of microtubules are considered constitutive expression. Positive control. Okay, when we talk about positive controls, that means that you can stimulate gene expression. But when I say positive control, I want you to immediately think there is an inducer. Okay. An inducer is a molecule that increases expression of a gene. Negative control means that you can inhibit or knock down gene expression. Okay. So I want you to think in terms of this. We'll have a molecule called a repressor. Okay. And that decreases expression. Because it's going to get complicated here in a few minutes. And we'll talk about positive systems in which you can actually decrease the levels of expression, negative controlled system in which you can actually increase the levels of expression. But with positive control, you will always have an inducer that has the ability to increase expression. With negative controls, you'll have a repressor that has the ability to decrease levels of expression. Okay? So if it gets dicey and stormy in your mind about these things, this is the life preserver to hang on to. This is the big piece of wood that you can float on and leave poor Jack out to freeze to death, whatever. I didn't see Mythbusters. Was the piece of wood big enough for both of them?
It was big enough, but the density was... his weight plus her weight would actually cause it to sink.
Counting her life jacket? Didn't she have a life jacket on, too?
Well,
okay.
He would have.
Yeah, she's just selfish. Women. Guys are with me on this one, right? She's right. In her heart, she was longing for Billy Zane or whatever. He lived happily ever after, didn't he? So, didn't he? Woke up on a beach, yeah. The bad rich guys always win. In the end, Lex Luthor will still be here. All right, so levels of gene expression. There are a lot, we've talked about transcription translation. There are a lot of different steps in it. And all of these things can be involved in the ultimate regulation of expression of a gene. Okay. A big part of it is when we talked about compaction, where the DNA is wrapped around the histones, and then you've got chromatin, and the chromatin is bundled up. All of that has to be undone to get access to the gene for transcription to take place. This is one of the hot areas of research in molecular biology right now. In fact, we did a job search last fall for a genome biologist, and probably half the candidates that we got are involved in chromatin restructuring that allows gene expression to be regulated. So that plays in with DNA access. Transcription, okay, just initiation, how strongly does it take place? RNA modification and stability. If you've got an RNA molecule that's got a long half-life, you'll be able to make more protein off of it than you will if the RNA molecule just is there for a few minutes and then it's degraded, either naturally or as a result of RNA interference. Translation, same thing with translation. It is mainly regulated at the point of initiation, but we'll talk about a system in which ribosomes can actually stall out on an mRNA molecule in the middle, not at the end where the tmRNA molecule can help, but RNA molecules will stall in the middle because the conditions inside the cell are adjusting so rapidly that that protein is no longer needed. And then there's post-translational modification. You can have an enzyme that's produced or a protein that's produced, and it could be inactivated. So if we follow gene expression from the information contained on DNA to a biological activity, okay, that you can have the protein present, but if it's inactivated or it's inhibited, you really don't have that biological activity. So in some worlds, that's considered you don't have gene expression. Okay, and these are just what I told you, and if you're more of a visual person, the types of things that we'll be talking about. All right, a big player in regulation of gene expression will be DNA binding proteins. And that's terrible verb agreement. Anybody see the trailer for Iron Man 3 yet? Mandarin says something like, "Heroes, there is no such thing." And I want to slap him. It's like, so I assume that that's an edited blurb and they threw them together and they don't care about verb agreement at Marvel anymore. He sounds very Bane-like, by the way. So DNA binding proteins are proteins that will interact with DNA. And when we talk about these inducers and repressors, many of them will be proteins. Now, as many of you demonstrated, you are aware of the fact that DNA is a double-stranded molecule, and as a result, DNA binding proteins tend to be dimeric. They tend to have two components that will bind to a double-stranded structure. But there are three main types of DNA binding proteins that I want you to know. We'll get into them in a minute. but they all have special regions present on the protein. If you ever work in molecular biology and you come up on something that's a DNA binding protein, there are conserved shapes in these proteins called motifs. And they are the area that actually facilitates binding to the DNA. And the amino acids present at the motif kind of tells you which type of a DNA binding protein that it is. Okay, so these are the three that I want you to know. Let me see if we've got these one-on-one. The helix turn helix. And it gets that name because these cylinders represent alpha helices present in the DNA binding protein, and then there's a short turn. There's a flexible stretch of amino acids between them that gives it a little turn. And then what happens is the helix will intercalate into, it will fit into the major groove of DNA. So here we see it in there. The other thing, these are dimers, right? So they're made up of two molecules. This isn't one protein here, one protein here. These tend to go off other directions, but there will be a dimer binding helix as well. So there'll be part of the protein that will interact with a copy of itself, and the other part of the protein will interact with the major groove on DNA. And so they will bind in a configuration like this, but if you know helix turn helix, two alpha helices separated by a short, flexible stretch of amino acids. Helix turn helix motifs are the most common ones that we'll see in prokaryotic regulation. Then there are ones called zinc fingers. And in zinc fingers, they're called that because they require zinc to take on their active configuration. Again, these are dimeric molecules. And they use zinc to get relatively small helices into the groove of DNA. Excuse me. If we go back to the helix turn helix, there are fairly long helices that are interacting with the major groove. Zinc fingers have shorter helices, but the zinc ions are there to pull the protein into an active configuration where it binds. If you don't have zinc, then it won't hold together. And actually, they're called fingers because you get these large loop-like structures that if you just look at them in two dimensions, kind of look like finger-like projections. Then the last one is a leucine zipper. And here we've got, again, it's a dimeric molecule. It's got two components, two major components. We've got the DNA binding domain, and then we've got the subunit binding where it binds to its partner. And the part that will bind to the other copy of itself has multiple copies of leucine on it. And the leucines will overlap each other and interact, and you get two helices that are lined up and they're held together in the middle by leucine, and you can peel them apart so it looks and behaves much like a zipper. Okay. Then the DNA binding loops or helices are actually pretty extensive in a leucine zipper, and they curve around the DNA structure. With a helix turn helix, they're just fairly straight and they just nest in here. With the leucine zipper, they wrap around, and it's a fairly intimate interaction that they're making. Okay, but leucine zippers, zinc fingers are more common in eukaryotes than there are than they are in prokaryotes. And then there are a few others. Steroid receptors have a different structure. Steroid receptors are interesting molecules because they hang out in the cytoplasm of your cell. When a fat-based steroid enters the cell, they interact with the steroid receptor, and then that allows it to traverse the nuclear membrane and they interact with DNA. So they have to do a couple of different things. They have to recognize a steroid, and they have to then be able to pass the nuclear membrane and bind DNA. But if you take endocrinology, you'll spend a lot of time talking about endocrine receptors. And they're held together by hydrogen bonds. When these proteins bind to DNA, they're not forming covalent bonds. They're forming hydrogen bonds. And so one of the things that you have to overcome, I've mentioned this before, in addition to DNA being a straight molecule in books and molecules associated with DNA being large pastel-shaded ovals or rectangles, you tend to think in terms of when a molecule is bound to DNA, it stays bound to DNA, and that's not true. These molecules will bind to DNA. They'll be held on loosely by hydrogen bonds for a brief period of time, and they'll dissociate, and then they'll reassociate, and they'll dissociate. So it's this constant binding and unbinding of the DNA by the proteins. That gives us little gaps of time in which the molecule is no longer bound. And when we want to change regulation, we need that. If the protein is just always on there, it gets really tough to remove it, pry it off. The fact that it's held on by relatively weak bonds makes it much easier to dislodge. So hydrogen bonds, not covalent bonds. Okay. Now some terminology with some structures on the DNA. Okay, operon and prokaryotes. Operon is a functional group. So you've got a promoter, and remember in bacteria, the promoter is the minus 10 and minus 35 sequences, but the minus 10 is most important. And then you've got the transcription start site. Okay. And remember that most often is an A in the middle of the CAT triplet. That's downstream from the promoter. But there is oftentimes a regulatory sequence someplace between the promoter and the actual structural part of the gene or the open reading frame part of the gene, and that's referred to as an operator. Okay. And that's where regulatory molecules will bind. So an operon is promoter, any regulatory sequences, and then the actual part of the gene that will result in the RNA molecule. Okay, inducible, repressible. Inducible means, okay, these are not just different words for the things that we just talked about with positive and negative regulation. This is taking into account the normal state of a gene and the altered state of a gene. Okay? So if we've got inducible genes, that means that they are normally off, but they can be turned on. If you've got a repressible gene or operon, okay, then transcription is normally on, but can be turned off. Okay. Again, these do not replace positive and negative. You can have positive inducible, negative inducible, positive repressible, negative repressible. And we're going to talk about mechanisms by which you could see all four of those combinations. And you need to make sure that you're good with positive, negative, inducible, and repressible. Okay. So we're going to start with the mechanisms of how you can have these four things. A negative inducible operon. Okay? Negative tells you there's a repressor molecule. Inducer tells you that this thing is normally off. It's normally not transcribed, but you can cause it to be transcribed. Okay? So, here's a mechanism for a negative inducible operon. Okay? The idea of the operator is if you can bind a protein in the area between the promoter and the transcriptional start site, you can either prevent RNA polymerase from binding if it's close enough to the promoter, or if it does bind, you could prevent it from reading through. That physically, you've got this protein sitting there interacting with the DNA, and it's just going to be in the way when RNA polymerase comes along. Okay? Remember, RNA polymerase is held to the DNA molecule by hydrogen bonds as well. So it's not a case of RNA polymerase has a stronger affinity for the DNA molecule. DNA binding proteins can interfere with it. So here's the regulatory region, the operator, and here's the operator here. There is another gene. Sometimes they're just next door. Sometimes they're all the way across the genome. And it makes a protein that will bind to the operator. And so that protein is a repressor. This is a negative inducible system, so that means we've got a repressor. In this case, the repressor is this protein. It's binding the operator, and that prevents RNA polymerase from binding and moving down the gene. Okay. One trick that prokaryotes do is there's something called a polycistronic operon. And in a polycistronic operon, you'll have one promoter, and then you'll have multiple genes. So you just get one large transcript that's produced that you can produce three different proteins from, but it only takes a single promoter. So in the bacterial world, if you've got three genes that you need kind of regulated all together, if they're all part of the same process, a really convenient way to do that is to put them in a polycistronic operon with one promoter. You regulate that single promoter, and you can adjust all three of these up or down. What we'll see in eukaryotes is the way that they will do that is someplace on their chromosomes they will have 1, 2, and 3. And then what they'll have is very similar promoter regions upstream of each one of them. And these are referred to as gene families or regulatory families. When 1, 2, and 3 can be regulated under the same conditions, but each one of them will have their own promoter that will be regulated under those conditions. Bacteria, let's handle it at the DNA level so we don't have to make as many regulatory proteins. And so we'll just line up 1, 2, and 3 together. So in this example, they're showing you these structural genes of D, E, and F are the ones that we want to transcribe. But this repressor is binding. This protein will bind to the operator if we just leave it alone. Okay? It's negative, so it's got the repressor. It's inducible, which means it's normally off. So we've met the first components or the first requirements of that definition. We've got a repressor and this thing is normally off. Now we need to figure out how to turn it on. Okay? And the way that we turn it on is with a molecule called an inducer. And this is one of the changes in terminology since I was a student. Because when I was a student, we were a little bit more technically correct, and we would call this derepression as opposed to induction. But we've got a molecule that will increase the rate of transcription at the gene, so we call it an inducer. And the way that it will do it is bind to the repressor and change the affinity of the repressor for the operator sequence. So in this case, we don't have an inducer present. The repressor will bind to the operator. We don't get transcription. Now we've got an inducer that's present. It will bind to the repressor molecule, and now the repressor molecule can't bind to the operator. And without that repressor molecule at the operator, now RNA polymerase can come in, bind, and can transcribe genes D, E, and F. So that's a negative inducible. Okay. Now let's look at a negative repressible. Negative repressible means there will be a repressor involved in it, and it means that normally it's on, but it can be turned off. Okay. And so in this case, instead of an inducer, we'll have a molecule called a co-repressor that will manipulate the repressor into when it binds, when it doesn't bind. Okay, so with negative repressible, since it's repressible, so since it's repressible, normally it will be on. And it's negative, so we've got a repressor. If it's normally on, that means the repressor normally isn't binding to the DNA. If it was, it would be off. So what we've got here is, without the co-repressor, the repressor molecule can't bind to the operator. And under those conditions, RNA polymerase can, and it will transcribe these. Now we've shifted down the alphabet a little bit. We've got genes G, H, and I. Okay. And you get transcription of these genes. Okay. One of the traits of a negative repressible operon is the co-repressor is oftentimes one of the products involved in the pathway. Okay, so either it's it can in some cases be one of the actual gene products itself, one of the proteins, or more often it's a metabolic product of one of the enzymes that's expressed by that. Okay, and we'll talk about a specific example in a little bit, but you get an accumulation of a product in the cell as a result of these genes being expressed, and that molecule comes back and acts as a co-repressor. So when you get a buildup of this product U will interact with the inactive repressor and activate it. So once it's bound by the repressor now binds to the operator, and that prevents the RNA polymerase from binding, or if it binds, it prevents it from moving down. Okay, so you are synthesizing this molecule. When you get enough of this molecule, you want to shut down that pathway. Right? It's a feedback mechanism. We've got enough of this. Let's shut it back or shut it down. So as a result, if you see a repressible system, they tend to be repressed, or the repression tends to be kicked in by an accumulation of a product of the cell. Okay? So that's how it's normally on, but we can turn it off. That repressor is present all the time. It's just whether it's interacting, in this case, with the co-repressor or in the previous case, with the inducer. All right? Now we're going to look at positive operons. So positive tells you that there's an activator. Okay, they're calling him an activator in this book. So there is a protein that will bind that will increase the levels of transcription. Okay. And normally this would be slightly upstream of the promoter. Okay, with negative regulation, it's just easy to physically block the polymerase from the genes. With positive regulation, you're binding generally closer and upstream to the promoter. And it'll be a protein that helps recruit RNA polymerase. Okay. So with positive inducible, that means we've got an activator, but it's normally not bound to the DNA, and so we can alter it and increase levels of transcription. Okay. Here they're showing transcription off. Oftentimes with positive inducible. There may be low levels of transcription without it, but you can significantly increase it. So what happens then is we have a molecule that builds up, and it's a substrate. So it's something that, it's a molecule that we can manipulate enzymatically, but we haven't yet. And as that accumulates, the substrate accumulates, it interacts with the activator and induces it. And so that now it takes on a form where it will bind the DNA, and the activator helps recruit RNA polymerase. Okay? So with the negative control, the negative repressible, we had the end product of an enzymatic pathway acted as the co-repressor. Right? You've got enough of something that you're making, it's time to shut it down. What we see with positive inducibles is it's the starting material. Okay, you don't want to produce enzymes to break down a certain substrate unless you've got enough of the substrate to warrant it. So over time, you get this accumulation of a substrate. Now there's enough. It starts interacting with this activator, and it turns on those genes that encode the proteins that will break down that substrate. Okay. If nothing else, I want you to think in terms of these regulatory mechanisms, when they would make sense, under what conditions they would make sense. Okay? So if you've got an accumulation of a substrate, you want to turn those genes on to modify that substrate. The substrate can act as a to help induce an activator. All right, positive repressible. We still have an activator, but now normally it's bound to the DNA. Normally it's on, and we're going to turn it off. That's what repressible means. So it's normally active by itself, and we'll recruit RNA polymerase. We get transcription, and we need to turn it off. So what happens is the accumulation of the end product. Okay, so we're carrying out this enzymatic step. Here's the substrate. Here's the product. The accumulation of the product will inactivate the activator so that it doesn't bind. So with repressibles, you normally see repressibles associated with end products, accumulation of end products, and inducible associated with the starting material of a biochemical pathway. Okay. If you've got enough of the starting material, then it's time to make the donuts biochemically. If you've got enough of the end product and it's time to shut something down, you're repressing it after you've got an accumulation of what you're trying to make. Okay. All right, so now we're going to look, these are sort of generic ones. We're going to look at a specific operon of E. coli, the bacterium. This is, I would say, this is the most thoroughly studied regulatory mechanism in molecular biology. It's sort of a rite of passage that you have to understand the lac operon. And there are a couple of things that are going on here. So the lac operon is involved in carbohydrate utilization, sugar utilization. And there are multiple genes involved. But what I want you to know, this is a negative inducible operon. Okay. And let's just look at a picture here. So we've got three structural genes involved. You don't really need to know what they do, but they're involved in bringing in sugars and modifying them. Okay. So here we've got the promoter. We've got a regulatory read or a regulatory gene that makes a LacI protein. Okay. And the LacI protein is the repressor for the lac operon. This is the lac operon over here. This is the regulatory gene. And so this allows bacteria to utilize lactose as a sugar source. Okay. And so it's working with lactose. And so if in the absence of lactose, the repressor will bind to the operator region and you don't get transcription. Okay? That should make sense. Why do we want to manipulate a sugar that's not here? So under no lactose, we get no transcription of these genes. If there is lactose present, what happens is lactose is modified to a slightly altered molecule called allolactose. Allolactose is will inactivate the repressor molecule. It will de-repress it, okay? But induce, if you say it induces, it's fine, but it actually prevents the repressor from binding. Okay. So we've got lactose present. You get this derivative of lactose that signals there's lactose in the cell. Now we keep that repressor from shutting off the genes. Now we can produce these genes so that we can start utilizing lactose. And lactose is modified to galactose and glucose. Okay. So it's negative because we've got a repressor, but it's a inducible system. So, did they tell you that? Yep. So, it's a negative inducible operon. Okay, but here's what's going on with the structure of the promoter region. Okay, you've got the minus 10, minus 35. Here's the operator region, and then here's the repressor. And the repressor overlaps the transcription start site, so it prevents RNA polymerase from transcribing the gene. And that's a really nice, clean story, except that we've got this thing that pops up with organisms, and that is not all their food sources are equally good in their world. Okay? If you are a bacterium, particularly an E. coli, glucose is your favorite food. Okay? And the cell deals with glucose much more efficiently than it does other carbohydrates. And so in a bacterial world, remember, they want to be efficient. They don't want to waste time transcribing genes to break down lactose if they already have a preferred carbohydrate to break down. You know, lactose is kind of, in case of emergency, break glass carbohydrate. So there's this general regulatory process called catabolite repression. And what catabolite repression means is when glucose is present, it's the preferred carbohydrate and other metabolic pathways will be shut down as long as glucose is present. Okay? And catabolite repression is generally a positive control mechanism. So we just talked about the regular regulation, the normal regulation of the lactose or the lac operon is a negative inducible one. But now we've got this overreaching regulation called catabolite repression in which it's a positive control. That means we'll have an activator. And the activator is a specific protein called CAP. It's a catabolite activator protein. So CAP's the activator for catabolite repression. Okay. And we need to take a little sidestep here into cell biology for a minute. Okay, remember, as if cells are doing well, they're using their carbohydrates, they're running them through respiration, and they're producing ATP molecules. And ATP, then, they use the energy in those, the bond between the second and third phosphate to drive a lot of biochemical reactions. If the cell's not doing well, if it doesn't have a lot of food sources available, respiration slows down, ATP production slows down. So you get an accumulation of ADP. Okay? If the cell is really not doing well, it will start scavenging ADPs. It will use that energy and the bond between the first and second phosphate on an ADP molecule. It's not as energetically favorable to do that, so it's kind of an emergency measure that the cell does. And if you start breaking down ADP, you get an accumulation of AMP. Okay, so you go from ATP to ADP to AMP. Over here, the cell is happy. Over here, the cell's pretty close to dead. Okay, so the higher the levels of ATP, that indicates the cell doing well. If a cell is stressed, you see high levels of AMP. AMP will typically take a cyclic form, so we write it AMP for, this should be a small case, cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is one of the universal indicators of cell stress. In fact, you could take a cell, give it all the food it wants in the world, and if you take a microinjector and give it a big boost of cyclic AMP, that cell gets all panicky, thinks it's about to die, even if it's got glucose around. That high concentration of cyclic AMP is a cellular indicator of stress. The cell's not doing well, it's starving, it's had to start breaking down ATP, and it had to start breaking down ADP. So what CAP will interact with is cyclic AMP. Okay? If a cell isn't doing well, then you'll get cyclic AMP will accumulate and it will bind to CAP. So here's what's going on. And we're going to revisit because we've been talking about lactose and the lac operon. Lac is not the preferred carbohydrate, so the lac operon falls under catabolite repression. The normal transcription is negative inducible, but now we're throwing in this positive regulatory mechanism, and we'll show you how both of them interact to come up with a regulation that makes sense. Okay? So when glucose is low, okay, that means the cell is not doing well. Its preferred sugar is not there. It's not making ATP, so we'll have a high concentration of cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP will bind to CAP, and now CAP will bind upstream of the promoter region. And CAP bound upstream of the promoter region dramatically increases initiation of the RNA polymerase at that promoter. Okay? So we get an increase in initiation, and then if nothing else is standing in the way, the RNA polymerase will go down and transcribe these genes. But CAP affects initiation. The repressor affects whether or not, once it binds, whether or not it can actually transcribe the genes. When glucose levels are high, there's very little cyclic AMP. The cell's fat and happy. It's good to go. It doesn't need to use lactose. So you don't see the push for cyclic AMP binding to CAP. It still will a little bit if there's a small amount of cyclic AMP. They will occasionally still bind to CAP and do this, but it happens much less often when glucose levels are high. And so RNA polymerase will still initiate, but it does so at a much, much lower level than when CAP is present. Okay? So CAP dramatically ramps up the level of initiation. All right. So now we'll throw in the combination of these things. Oh, okay. So your book doesn't do that. We're going to look at the combinations now. If we've got low glucose, so the cell's not doing well. If we have lactose present, okay, no glucose but lactose present, if you're a bacterial cell, just common sense, okay, if I don't have you think in terms of mechanism, I just ask you, if you're a bacterial cell and you're starving, you don't have glucose but there is lactose present, do you want to break that lactose down for food? You're going to go, yeah, that makes sense. My preferred food's not here, but I've got this secondary food source. Let's use it so I don't die. In terms of mechanisms, how that plays out is CAP binds because there's a lot of cyclic AMP, and since there's lactose present, You get allolactose that acts to de-repress the repressor. It removes the repressor from the operator. So now you get high levels of initiation because of the cyclic AMP cap, and you don't get repression. And so you would have high levels of transcription of these genes. No glucose, there is lactose. Let's make a lot of these enzymes and get us some energy. If you have no glucose and no lactose, right? So you're starving, you don't have a preferred energy source, and there's no sign that you've got a good secondary energy source in lactose. Do you want to then waste a lot of energy making enzymes to break down something that's not there? You don't. You want to conserve your energy as long as you can and wait until a food source shows up. So if there's no glucose, we still get this cap binding, and so RNA polymerase will initiate. Okay. It will initiate at a high level, but if there's no lactose, the repressor is still sitting here at the operator, and so we don't get transcription. We don't waste energy transcribing and translating those genes to produce a protein that we don't need. Okay. Now, when glucose is high, okay, we don't see much initiation. We're going to break down the glucose. That's our preferred source. And if we've got a preferred source and we don't have any lactose at all, as a cell, does it make sense to waste energy on these enzymes? No, it doesn't. And so if we've got glucose is high, there's low levels of initiation, but if there's no lactose, the repressor is still there. And so even if you get initiation at a lower level, it won't continue through and transcribe the genes. The repressor will prevent it. Okay? So you get essentially no transcription with high glucose, no or low lactose. Where you get the high levels of expression, no glucose, but you do have lactose. Then if you've got both glucose and lactose, that's kind of a middle ground. If you're a cell, it's like, okay, you've got your preferred source, but now you also have this other carbon source. Well, you're more efficient using glucose, but you don't want to ignore the lactose. You want to, you know, kind of roll it in as you can, as energy allows. And so when glucose is high, you don't see an increase at initiation because cap's not bound. But if lactose is present, you'll de-repress. You will remove the repressor from the operator because lactose will convert to allolactose. And so you'll have low levels of initiation, but when it does initiate, it's allowed to transcribe. So you spend a little bit of energy breaking down the lactose when you've got a lot of glucose and lactose both around, but you're not, you know, you're not diverting a lot of energy to utilize lactose because you don't have to. But it's still there, so you don't want it just laying around doing nothing. So those two regulatory mechanisms, the negative inducible of the promoter, whether it allows transcription to take place or not, and then the positive regulation of catabolite repression that determines the preference of glucose over lactose. It takes two individual mechanisms, but now you've got a gene that is regulated in something that should make sense to you on a common sense level within a cell, depending on the balance of glucose and lactose. All right, so that's one that takes place strictly at the level of transcription. We'll look at another one, the TRP operon. TRP is for tryptophan biosynthesis. That's why it's abbreviated TRP. There are five structural genes that encode enzymes that convert a precursor to tryptophan. Okay, so with the LAC operon, we're a catabolic process. We're taking lactose and we're breaking it down to glucose and galactose. With the TRP operon, we're anabolic. We're taking something, modifying it, and building it up into tryptophan. So the first one's catabolic pathway. This one's an anabolic pathway, and they're regulated differently. Okay. So all of these are involved in this anabolic process. There is a And regulatory molecule, the TRPR, that's part of a separate region on the chromosome. Here's our TRP operon. We've got an operator. Okay. So when tryptophan is low, when TRP is low, we want to be expressing these genes. Okay, because we need tryptophan made. So under low tryptophan conditions, our repressor doesn't bind, and we see expression of these genes. Okay? But when TRP is high, when we've got enough tryptophan in the cell, we don't need to express these genes. Expressing five genes is fairly expensive to a bacterium. If you've got 4,000 genes total in your genome, five constitutes a fairly significant portion of those genes. And so you don't want to waste expressing five genes if you already have enough tryptophan. So what happens is tryptophan binds the repressor and it makes it active. So tryptophan is the co-repressor. The accumulation of tryptophan allows the co-repressor, and now the repressor is active, it binds at the operator, and we don't see transcription of the TRP gene. Okay? So that's where you would see the difference between a catabolic process where it's the accumulation of the substrate as opposed to an anabolic process where it's the accumulation of the end product that shuts it off. Okay. All right, but then TRP does something else that there are a lot of anabolic pathways. The reason why they use TRP is TRP does this other thing, and that is, some cases, you can have initiation take place, you can have transcription begin, and if you hit the threshold where you now have enough, it would be useful to stop ribosomes from translating those molecules and also stop transcription from making any more. And there's a process called attenuation. Attenuate is a wonderful word. If it's not on the ACT or the GRE, it should. Attenuate just means to modify in a slightly downward fashion. So you could tell somebody that they need to attenuate their response. So it's the Harvard way of saying check yourself before you wreck yourself kind of thing. So if you think of something that rhymes well with attenuate, we're in business. Attenuate before you disingenuate yourself or something. But attenuation means we're going to take a level that's there and we're just going to throttle it back a little bit. And this mechanism is referred to as the TRP attenuator because we're going to take something that's already been initiated and we're going to bring it back. We're going to throttle it back because we're starting to get tryptophan levels that are intermediate. Okay? All right, so there is a region on one of the TRP genes, the TRPE gene, that has a 5' untranslated region. Okay, so here's what the TRP operon looks like. Here's the ribosomal binding site, the promoter's up here. Okay, here's the start codon. And then we've got this 5' untranslated that corresponds up here. Okay, and then here's the actual TRPE gene with the start codon. Okay, this thing will make it's got a start codon and it makes a non-functional protein. Okay, but right in the middle of here, we've got four main regions, 1, 2, 3, and 4. There's a bunch of codons that encode for tryptophan. Okay, so what will happen is, these regions, when the RNA molecule is being produced, these regions have complementary bases that will interact with each other. Remember, RNA hates being single-stranded. It will try to find complementary regions that will interact with each other. So here's some possibilities. Okay, so we've got a case where 1 will bind to 2, and 3 will interact with 4. Okay, and if you get 1 interacting with 2, 3 interacting with 4, you cause transcription to stop. Okay? It basically does that job like a terminator loop. Okay? That you get this stem loop structure that forms when one interacts with two, three to four. That happens when tryptophan levels are starting to increase. Okay? So if tryptophan's relatively high concentration, when the ribosomes get to that region where there are a lot of trip codons, if there's a lot of tryptophan, that means a lot of tRNA has been charged with tryptophan, and the ribosome just slides right through it. It doesn't stall out at those tryptophan codons. And when the ribosome moves through, one interacts with two, three interacts with four. Okay? When tryptophan level is low, the ribosome gets to those trip codons, and there's not a lot of tryptophan, so there's not much tRNA charged with tryptophan, so the ribosome kind of has to stand around, wait on the tRNA to bring tryptophan to it. And when it stalls out at that position with the trip codons, that prevents one from interacting with two. And instead what happens is two will interact with three, form complementary base pairs, and three then isn't free to interact with four. Okay? So when tryptophan levels are low, it makes a different structure that does not terminate transcription. You need those genes to be transcribed because tryptophan's low. So we're not quite high enough on the tryptophan level, so the ribosome stalls out and you get this configuration. Think about the ribosome being bound to the polytrip region is the creepy roommate that won't leave when you're trying to hook up. One is looking to get it on with two, but the ribosome is saying, hey, how's it going, guys? Yeah, they can't take the hint. And just, so what happens is if the ribosome's there, two just decides, okay. Three that I met in biology class last week is almost as good as one, so two's going to go hook up with three who doesn't have a creepy roommate hanging around. So trip attenuation is like Saturday night in the dorm. Okay? Okay, but it's a level of regulation that's different than that inducible interaction about whether you've got TRIP, yes or no. Now it's a level of how rapidly is TRIP increasing to attenuate. It's a fine-tuned knob, whereas the inducible one was, is it on, yes or no? Now the attenuator is adjusting it down just a little bit. And this is just a picture showing that it happens, it's the mRNA structure that's doing it. Remember, it's in a bacterial system, transcription and translation are happening at the same time. This mechanism would not work in a eukaryote because transcription and translation are separated. So you wouldn't get the RNA polymerase moving along the DNA at the same time that its product was being translated. So the TRIP attenuator would only work in a prokaryotic system for that reason. Okay, all right, then, kind of briefly, since we talked about this the other day, the other way that you can regulate things are affecting the levels of translation by antisense RNA. So remember the RNA inhibition that we talked about with microRNA. And satellite RNA, I want you to keep those in mind as a regulatory mechanism, that if you've got RNA that's already been transcribed, but you've got enough of that, you don't want to waste energy making those proteins anymore, that complementary RNA molecules can be used to either prevent translation or to result in the degradation. All right, then there's another thing, one more thing, which is called riboswitch. And that is, mRNA molecules themselves have regulatory sequences that molecules can bind. And it affects the formation of secondary structures that either lend themselves to higher levels of translation, or in some cases, riboswitches can shut off translation. So we've got an mRNA molecule, we've got an untranslated region here, a 5' untranslated region, and it makes a three-dimensional structure that can be bound by a regulatory protein. This regulatory protein then binds the structure, and when it's in this configuration, that basically hides the ribosomal binding site. Remember, ribosomes want to find that ribosomal binding site, the Shine-Delgarno, to initiate just upstream of the start codon a little bit. In this riboswitch, the presence of a regulatory protein causes it to take on a three-dimensional conformation that blocks access of the ribosome to that ribosome binding site. So you actually are having gene expression regulated at the mRNA level after it's been produced. So it's you've expended the energy of transcription, but now you want to not expend the energy of translation. You don't need that protein anymore. And in many cases, the end product protein itself has the ability to come back and act as the riboswitch. Okay. If that regulatory protein is not present, it doesn't stabilize the riboswitch. It leaves a little bit more of an opening down here, so now the ribosome can access that ribosomal binding site and translation can take place. But remember, this is an RNA molecule, not a DNA molecule. When we were talking about the promoters and operators, that was always proteins binding to the DNA. Okay, so if you came in late, check for an important email coming your way about ways that you can get extra points on exam 2. The homework is due on Tuesday, homework 7, and the test will be available tomorrow at noon for you to pick up.
Actually, yeah, I was